This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen with you on today's episode. We are bringing you some fantastic guests across a whole range of topics. Speaking to a 10-year-old campaigner looking to make Dubai streets more safe with Stay Cool, Wear a Helmet to School. We were broadcasting live from SeaWorld Yas Island Abu Dhabi and in conversation with their general curator, Rob Yordi, on what's been happening behind the scenes for the welfare of the animals and, of course, for the visitor experience too. In conversation with Michelle from Kids Mobile App, saving you some dirhams and sorting out your summer. We were also in hand about all things family, from making sure your tots, your teens get some sleep when you travel, to helping out with some exam stress too with Hanan from the Family Hub. He's just popped by to shed some light on this project, what's been going on behind the scenes and what's been going on for quite some time. Rob Yordi is with us. He's been part of the SeaWorld Yas Island Abu Dhabi project since the early stages back in 2016. He's the general curator, leading the zoological department, responsible for so many aspects of animal health and welfare, plus rescue, rehabilitation, return operations at the Yas SeaWorld Research and Rescue Program, dedicating his life to the conservation of animals and fighting against animal poaching as well. Rob, probably the busiest man on Yas Island. Thank you so much for your time today. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. Happy World Ocean Day to all of the listeners. But I do have to say, I know the answer to your
question.
You're
not allowed to win.
I'm not going to say it, but I'm going to tell you that I do have a better job than he does. So.
Well, I have to say, massive congratulations to you and the team. It's fantastic to be here. And I'd love to know a little bit about the process, because why do you feel like Abu Dhabi was the right place for this venture?
So in the early stages of putting together SeaWorld Yas Island Abu Dhabi, we had conversations with a number of different groups, but I will tell you that it was the Meral message and the Meral vision and the people at Meral, especially the chairman, who really convinced our leadership that this was the right place to be. We looked at the history of the ocean with Abu Dhabi between seafaring, trade, pearl diving, fishing, everything had to do with the ocean itself, which is what our focus is and our message is about how important the ocean is to everybody. Looking at that and looking at the region and where the region is going to go, I will tell you what I've seen over the last 7.5 years is incredible. I actually got to watch the Warner Brothers World Park be built and now see that come to fruition and know that we were with the right partner. So it told us that we were with the right people, but it truly had to do with marrying 60 years of SeaWorld experience with the vision that Meral has for Yas Island, and they really couldn't be a better partner for us.
Well, as you say, this is all about the future of this region and moving forward. But I want to know about you. You've been in this role, in this environment for 30 years now. But what is the role of a curator? What does that actually look like here?
So in the role I'm currently in as general curator, I'm really lucky to have one of the most dynamic and amazing zoological staffs you could ever imagine. I've worked in a lot of zoos around the world and I've worked with a lot of facilities, and this team is just incredible. So my real job is making sure that they have the resources they need, they are supported, and I can go around and just enjoy what they're doing. I also have oversight over Yas SeaWorld Research and Rescue, so understanding what the scientists need, what the rescue team needs, and everything else, and just taking over 35 years of experience that I have with the SeaWorld parks and instilling that into the teams and the design and then what we're going to do to move forward. Because I will tell you, our animals teach us stuff every day that we need to be able to respond to.
It's been really fascinating to have a look around the various realms today, and I wanted to get a little understanding of maybe if there's any surprising facts about how some of these creatures coexist here at SeaWorld Yas Island. How does it all come together?
I think one of the really fun things about what you see in the habitats here at SeaWorld is the fact that they are all what we consider dynamic habitats. So that means the water system and the lighting system are set up not only for mammals, but for fish, for birds, for invertebrates, for reptiles. So we have a number of animals that may never have seen fish before, of our marine mammals, getting a chance to coexist with this. There's about 5,000 tropical fish that are in our dolphin habitats, and many of our dolphins have not seen fish before. And some of them are in their teens and into their 20s. So this was a big surprise to them. So see how they adjust to it, how they follow them around, or how the fish go and follow them directly. The other one that has just been really fun for me here is designing our sea otter habitat.
They're my favorites.
They are so incredible. But watching the guests watch them, because they are some of the most entertaining animals, but they are mischievous. Mm-hmm. They are looking to find ways. They are outsmarting us every day, and they're like the marine mammal version of an orangutan.
Oh, really?
You're always being outsmarted, and then you go back and respond. They're just incredibly smart animals, but they are so entertaining. And it's something that people in this region would never see. So seeing the response we get is really tells me we've done the right job.
And in terms of other behind the scenes, as you're saying, animal welfare is such a priority for you as general curator. What's been happening that visitors might not even be aware of that we're ultimately able to enjoy as visitors?
Probably the biggest news that we have is the week before we open, given our Global Humane Certification. So this is a level of animal welfare that less than 3% of the zoos and aquariums in the world actually accomplish.
Wow.
We went through a very rigorous review from the American Humane Association, who sponsors Global Humane, had four auditors out here, went through that, looked at every single aspect in front, behind the scenes, rescue, research, everything we do, and we came out to getting our certification. We are the first facility in the MENA region, and we are the first facility ever to be certified pre-opening.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Rob Yordi's with us today. I wanted to ask you, and as you alluded to earlier, you've been working with marine life, with anti-poaching, with even Clydesdale horses and dogs and all sorts over your last 35 years. But when we're looking at marine life in particular, and obviously where we are today, what comes to mind about techniques and technologies that have really changed in that time?
What we have seen is how we take care of our animals in our SeaWorld parks. You look over decades and decades and decades of change. They teach us every day. One of the things that's really exciting about this park, since we're indoors, which everybody, hope everybody grasps, this is a five-story indoor SeaWorld. This is the most incredible thing you could imagine.
I can't quite get my head around the scale. It's great for the step count, Rob. I tell you what.
I'm sure it is.
I earned my lunch today. But the scale is extraordinary.
But to do this right, we have to look at the knowledge we've gained from our Antarctica habitats and our penguin encounters at SeaWorld, which are subantarctic birds, but they're indoors, so we have to do the lighting correctly. Mm-hmm. We have had to create an advanced animal lighting system for every animal in the entire park. So instead of just one habitat, it's the entire park. The animals that have, the Arctic has a specific light cycle, and they have to have the right amount of UVA, UVB, full spectrum lighting. Antarctica is going to be separate. Tropical's got windows, but they're still going to get additional light as well. Abu Dhabi realm is going to be what you have off the coast. So it really is the next level of animal lighting systems that we've had to develop to make sure these animals have the best welfare possible.
I'd love to talk a little bit about the Abu Dhabi realm, because I'd love to hear from your point of view, who as I said, has traveled extensively. What do you think are some of the highlights when it comes to this region's marine environment?
It's been so amazing to me in the 7.5 years that I've been coming back and forth and now actually living in Abu Dhabi to be able to open the park, is the focus that in the history of the ocean with Abu Dhabi, whether it's been fishing, as I mentioned before, pearl diving, seafaring, trade, but that continues to grow. Seeing so many people getting out on the water, going to the beaches, all that. It's really more eyes for us for looking for animals that might be in distress so they can report back to us and we can respond quicker. But the one of the main things that really has amazed me for this region is the fact that the water temperature gets so warm, but there's still corals. They're coral species that live in such warm water. The research that's being done here, and SeaWorld Research and Rescue is partnering with New York University here in Abu Dhabi to continue their studies with corals. But if you can imagine, coral water temperatures around the world are rising.
Mm-hmm.
Those corals are going to have to adapt to a warmer climate that these corals already know how to do. So how can we study and how can we understand how they can do it, so hopefully influence how we can help manage other populations around the world?
Wow, let's talk about this, because you have got the UAE's first dedicated marine research, rescue, rehabilitation, return center. And this is supporting, yes, regional, but also those global conservation efforts as well, Rob. So what is the program all about, and how could, I guess, us as a community and people listening today really benefit from it and understand more?
So two focuses of it. There's actually three pillars for SeaWorld Research and Rescue. Education, which is one of the original pillars for SeaWorld itself. Research, which was one of our first pillars. And then wildlife rescue and rehabilitation. benefiting from the wildlife rehabilitation and rescue program is we are getting animals back out in the natural environment. We are set up to handle anything from dolphins to sea turtles to dugongs to seabirds to my personal favorite, sea snakes.
That's your favorite.
We want to be able to rescue and rehab and return them because
they're part of the... Can you return them away from me, please?
They're in part of the natural environment. They're an important part. So having all the right facilities to complement the work that's already done. The Environmental Agency Abu Dhabi does some incredible work in the region. There's some great rescue partners that are in the region. So we want to be able to do that. Rescue side, it's or in the research side as well, it's finding out what the region needs. Mm-hmm. And that's how the area is going to benefit. And then the third piece is having school groups come out to the center to be able to learn what we're doing.
And there are already a number of school groups here today at SeaWorld, yes. And so thank you so much for your time. Really fascinating to hear what's happening behind the scenes and ultimately be able to walk through the doors today. Rob Yordi, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're really excited
to have everybody come visit us.
It's been a pleasure so far. And I have to say, we're probably hanging around a little bit after 5 o'clock and having a go on some of those rides and roller coasters. Joining us live on the line to look behind the headlines and offer up some consumer advice. Do not part with your hard-earned dirhams on any gadgets until you've sought the advice of Kevin Sebastian, a.k.a. Knox Voyager. How are you, Kevin?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking. I think you've probably had a very busy week. There's been a huge amount of tech news, not just amongst, you know, you gadget lovers. It's a nice way of saying nerds. But for us as well, it's been a big week in the world of Apple. And I'd like to start with that, if that's okay with you, because we're talking about tech that could potentially even replace the iPhone. What's going on with the Vision Pro?
So this was a big surprise. Like, we all knew that Apple was working on a VR headset, so VR being virtual reality. But when they revealed the Vision Pro, they actually shocked a lot of people, myself included, and that rarely happens because they did not release a virtual reality headset in the purest sense. You can't call this virtual reality. It's what it's called, and what Apple is calling, a spatial computer. So more or less, if there's the closest thing that I can relate this to, it is the Google Glass. It was a very cool concept which actually got made. Apple just basically took that formula and made it much better.
I have to say, it looks a lot cooler than the Google Glasses. I think that's been a big thing. The aesthetic of it is much more appealing than perhaps those glasses that didn't quite tick all the boxes. So can we talk about, well, I want to talk about when, how much, and the why. What's their mission with the Vision Pro?
So that's a very good question, one that many people are actually asking Apple this. Like, what were you thinking when you were making such a thing? Because, well, let's face it, VR headsets have been around for quite some time. We have the HTC Vive, we have the Oculus from Meta. And there isn't, I wouldn't say there's a huge mass market for virtual reality, at least not yet. Mm. What Apple are trying to do is essentially bring all of that cool tech into, say, for example, I want to say consumer device, but the idea is to basically have a computer on your face. Now, on the when's next, early next year. For sure, we're going to see this in March of next year when the next round of Apple products release. How much is another can of worms? It's for $3,500, which translates to 13,000 dirhams here.
Oh, la la. Okay. I mean, let's be honest, that price is probably going to come down pretty quickly, but there's going to be a limited run of actual gadgets available. I heard about 150,000 initially, so I'm sure we'll be getting some interesting bids on eBay in that first push. So
absolutely.
Here's my worry, Kevin. We've talked about this before. I just worry that we're just going to be sitting on our sofas turning into just massive blobs interacting with people virtually rather than actually, you know, making eye contact. I don't know, being in fresh air. Is this the beginning of the end in my mind?
You know, every time we come on the show, we actually end up talking very dystopian topics about this. I'm an evangelist for technology, and each time I come and talk on the show, I'll be like, I really wish I could like defend this. So, if I don't see the point of wearing these goggles yet, if I'm wearing a $3,500 headset, I am not taking this outside. I'm not taking these outdoors. Mm-hmm. One more thing: the battery life on this headset is 2 hours only. So I know that Apple did a they didn't specify, like, they didn't actually bring it up, because yes, the whole point is watching 3D movies on the headset might be an incredible experience and everything. But you only have 2 hours.
Most movies longer. I mean, to be honest with you, not famed for their battery power. I'm someone who has abandoned their Apple Watch because I couldn't face charging it every night. So again, room for improvement there. Kevin Sebastian joining us live on the line. We're looking at the latest gadget news, taking your questions as well, and getting your take on what's been happening in the headlines. Apple's revolutionary Vision Pro AR/VR headset. Just 20 minutes ago, Apple talking about this on their website. You know, you'll be able to control it with your eyes, you know, with your Yeah, and Mona, I have to say, Mona's been in touch on the text line saying, it feels like we're going to be like the humans in WALL-E. Yes, I hear you. We're going to get the text line, Kevin. Great question here from Paul, given that we've got Eid coming up and, of course, the summer. Paul asking, we've got some long-haul flights coming up and I want to treat my wife to something to make it a bit more enjoyable, given that business class is beyond the budget. Any ideas? Kevin Sebastian, any gadgets that you cannot fly without?
Absolutely. There's one I always swear by, actually two, but this is the one that's most important. If you are on a long haul flight, you would also understand the pain of having a crying baby on a flight like that. And no, there's no offense to the mums. I actually salute the mums who would have to like endure having a baby
and,
on Eid.
And the dads. Or, the dads have got equal opportunity to be dealing with the torture of a crying baby.
Absolutely.
Believe me, no one is unhappier than the parents.
I've seen many dads like walk up and down
pacing
the aisle to the washroom and back. So yeah, I can completely like relate to their pain. But the one thing that I would actually swear by is the Sony WH-1000XM5 headphones. I know it's a mouthful, but it's basically the 1000XM5 headphones are noise-canceling pair in the headphones. They are for 1,200 dirhams, but there is a sale going on Amazon at the moment, if I understand correctly. And those headphones are a absolute lifesaver because they cut out all sense of sound from it. And I've had them for like 2 years. And I like maintain that they are one of the best headphones on the market. Like the Quiet Comfort headphones come very close to it, but I prefer Sony because they have better sound. And it also has extra features as well. So you can turn on ambient audio. Say, for example, an announcement on the plane is happening and your music is playing in the background. If you hold the headphone on one cup, on one side of the headphones, it'll actually filter that audio through. So it'll cut out all engine noise, all environmental sound, and it'll focus on like people's voices talking. So that's an amazing feature.
Just repeat for me, if you wouldn't mind, Kevin, the name of those headphones.
Sony WH-1000XM5.
Okay. I've just had a quick look on Amazon. That's why I was asking. And there were a couple of, as you said, they are currently on sale. Now, these ones in particular are close to 1,800 dirhams. They're currently on sale for around 1,100. So we're saving you money, Paul. We're saving you money. You might as well get a pair for yourself as well. So much to talk about, Kevin, in terms of headlines. So we are going to try and get through as many as possible. But looking internationally, tell you what, New York's having a bit of a shocker. We've got some really appalling air quality reports going on over there as a result of, I believe, Canadian wildfires. Any gadgets that you would send to our friends in the Big Apple?
Absolutely. So one of the things, and this was, honestly, I couldn't believe I'm even endorsing this kind of a product, because LG did something with the PureCare, if you remember, when we were in the pandemic and then masks were being developed. Dyson actually made this something. It made this headphone/mouth breathing mask. It's a very hybrid-looking thing, and it's a very funny-looking device as well. And everyone was making fun of that company, saying, why would you even want to make one of these? Why would you want to have a headphones and a mask combined? And wearing it makes you look like you're straight out of Back to the Future or Tron. Like, that's how futuristic this thing looks, and that's how ridiculous it looks. But the idea right now is, because of these wildfires, New York currently looks in a shade of orange. Like, if you see the videos coming out from New York City right now, it's like it's as if someone painted an Instagram filter on top of the entire city. And honestly, the air quality is like one of the most dangerous in the world right now. Like, even being there for 5 minutes can cause, like, it's an equivalent of like smoking for like a month or something like that. That's how dangerous the smoke is. The Dyson Zone, it makes a very good case because it actually filters that out and it gives you clean, breathable air. And it's actually, it's through a magnetic visor. And truth be told, like in a country like ours, in the UAE as well, or even in the Middle East, if there's like a sandstorm or something like that, and you have to like be outside, something like this can work. I don't endorse the fact that you can, you have to like buy something super expensive. We probably need cheaper, breathable technology, but this is the start of something bigger.
I don't want to sound, you know, too shallow, but they look really cool. The Dyson Zone, absolute
Yeah. Classes.
Headphones with air purification. As you say, we do need to have, first of all, shouldn't be a problem in the first place. Second of all, we do need to have some more cost effective, because, you know, it's going to be a case of only the richest survive when it comes to air quality. But my goodness, about 3,699 dirhams, but they look very cool and they might just match a hairdryer. No, I'm not sure I'm alone in this. I suspect not. But before kids, a holiday used to mean sleeping in, coming home from a trip well rested. And then you become a parent and learn, often the hard way, that vacation sleep is actually a lot worse than it is at home. So why is there such a common struggle for families with little kids? With Eid coming up and, of course, the summer, many of us taking trips home, having some holidays, hopefully. So from planes to new environments, we're bringing in the experts to help your little ones and you get some proper shut-eye. We've got paediatric sleep specialist Isabel of Savvy Sleep joining us now to help. Isabel, how are you?
Hi, Helen. I'm good, and you?
I'm very well, thank you. This is something that plagues so many families, you know, especially in this part of the world where people do love to travel and often do have to travel. What are some of the common barriers that you're hearing from families when it comes to sleeping while traveling? What are the pain points, Isabel?
Oh my God, there's so many. But us as expats, they're traveling all the time, right? So especially all the excitement around traveling and having to book a plane to either go back home or go to some holiday destination. So all of that, our kids pick up on it, right? And usually the pain points that we have to go through is, first of all, the plane is never at the correct time. So it's always going to mess up with nap, or you have to wake up your kids from a delicious sleep to pick up the plane, and then they're not going to sleep in the plane. So what do? Do you go to the hotel and then they're not going to sleep? They're not going to have the correct schedule because we have family around and we know how family is, right? So it's kind of like messy schedule, not sleeping in the normal environment. So sleep is off the window, right?
Right, well, let's talk about some actionable changes or indeed decisions that people can make. I'm always curious, are night or day flights better? And I'm thinking about your babies and your tots in particular, about getting them into a good sleep. What do you tend to recommend clients book, if you do have a choice, of course?
Yeah, that is a good question, because if you're thinking about your kids and if you want your kids to be sleeping most of the time, that book at night. But if you're like me, if you're a light sleeper, then you are probably not going to sleep. Mm-hmm. But for your kids, definitely nighttime, because our bodies are naturally more ready to fall asleep. So nighttime for sure.
Mine always seem to get so excited about the idea of sleeping on a plane and then somehow fight it and fight it and fight it until about half an hour before we land. And it's the most infuriating thing. I would say I probably don't help myself much because I often have a bit of a no rules on plane when it comes to food. I am just an absolute free for all. So this is something I'm looking to adjust over the summer, Isabel. What about jet lag in little ones? Any advice if you're going between time zones that could significantly disrupt their routine? Do you advise keeping kids on certain time zones, or are there any techniques regarding, I don't know, blackout blinds or antihistamines to get them back into a good rhythm?
Well, actually, the best thing that you can do is to jump into the new time zone straight away. I never recommend to do any adjustments beforehand because it generally doesn't work, because you're going into a plane and then the kids are not going to sleep. Mm-hmm. So what I say is, look, as soon as you get into destination, just go outside, get as much natural light as possible and jump into the new time zone. The first couple of days are going to be rocky for sure. But then after a couple of days, everything is going to be fine. They're going to be into the new time zone and everything should be okay. But yes, also, there are some things that are going to help. So definitely the two things that Sarah, my partner, and I recommend is to get white noise machine to block out all of the noises. If you're staying at that hotel or if you're staying with family, this helps tremendously. And also something to block out the light coming in through the windows. Those two things are a charm.
So white noise and blackout blinds. Isabel of Savvy Sleep joining us live. She's a pediatric sleep specialist, and we're talking about some of the tips and tricks, the techniques, and even the products that could help when it comes to sleeping on planes, adjusting to a new environment, whether you're traveling for Eid or indeed over the summer. We're just talking about blackout blinds there. A message here saying, when my kids were small, we always traveled with a roll of tin foil to block out light. Works so much better than blackout blinds and much cheaper. That is genius. And Sadie has been in touch, Isabel, saying, Eid trip. My kids are 10 and 12. The flight is 15 hours eastbound. They've always been rubbish at sleeping when traveling in cars, and I think they actively resist it. We don't want to arrive exhausted and jet lagged as the holidays only a week. We don't want to waste it recovering. Any tips or over-the-counter meds to help them get some sleep on the plane? We've got some good foam neck pillows, but would welcome any advice. What comes to mind? So 10 and 12, and she really wants them to get some shut-eye.
Well, at this age, I would generally recommend to use a little bit of melatonin for the plane. It's not something that we generally recommend, but if there is real difficulty, that's something we can do. And again, as soon as you get to your destination, do as much as you can in the sunlight and try to get them super tired. That's what I would say for a 10, 12 years old. Mm-hmm. I believe that as much as you can do, and also avoid television and blue light close to bedtime.
Okay, thank you for that. Have a brilliant time, Sadia. No Name One is saying, sleep, I need this talk. I've got an 18-month-old and our sleep is a mess. We made the mistake of getting her out of the cot one night and she's never gone back. We also can't get her off her midnight feed. Please send help. Right, so it sounds like a pretty desperate parent on 4001 as well. What comes to mind in terms of something they might not have thought of that you, with your experience, could apply in this situation?
Well, we work with a ton of people with the very same problem because it is a very common problem. And the thing is, once you see yourself in there, you don't know how you got there and you don't know how to get out of there. I will need to look into it with more detail, but you will most probably need to sleep train. There are just a handful of techniques, and you can always choose the one that sits best with you and be super consistent. Consistency is key. It's not a difficult thing to do to sleep train a child. It's just you need to be super, super consistent, and that's why we're valuable for families, because we help people stay consistent and normally not second-guess everything. But get that baby back in the crib and try as much as you can that the baby falls asleep in the crib. Once they realize that they can fall asleep in the crib, seriously, everything goes a lot better.
We had a situation with our 18-month-old where she just didn't want to be left in the room. So I was the mug that would spend an hour and a half every night just like holding her, rubbing her back. My husband would be off, you know, like watching TV and having dinner. And I was just lying there furious at the world. And in the end, I think you're right with sleep training. It is about consistency. And it's easier to be consistent at 7 o'clock at night than it is at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're knackered and you'll just do anything to get some sleep yourself. But we ended up kind of, and it took a long time, resting a hand on her and then moving the chair ever so slightly further and further away from the cot until we were literally sitting in the corridor. I was sitting in the corridor. And I think you're right, it's kind of helping them understand that they can self-soothe and it's not going to disorientate them if they wake up at midnight and you're not there, because they know how to fall asleep themselves. What about that midnight feed? Any advice for weaning off that?
Well, when we deal with something like this, we always recommend that you check first with your pediatrician that the baby can actually go through the night without a midnight feed. It's true that being 18 months old, I'm pretty sure that the baby can go without it. So at that age, I eliminate it completely, because the thing is that it's not a need anymore. It's a habit. Mm-hmm. And it's important to differentiate those two things, because if the baby doesn't need to eat and you're providing that feed only because the baby's requesting it, then he's never going to stop requesting it, right? So you need to stop it altogether. Like what I say with to our clients is, when you decide you want to stop smoking, you want to quit smoking, you stop smoking altogether. So in this situation, this is the way to go. If the baby was younger, then we can do it progressively. But at 18 months old, I would say just stop it, bite your tongue through it, and push through for just a couple of days. Generally, it takes a couple of days.
What about water instead of milk? Would that make any difference, or you think it's better just to remove the bottle or the
not
bottle
really.
Together? No, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Not really, because again, it's a habit. It okay. is a habit. So they're actually using that most of the time. They're using it to just get you back in the room with them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, believe me, I have been there. I really have. Yeah. And this is the thing with kids.
You think you've
cracked it, and then it's something else that comes up. Yeah, it never stops. Although I have to say, my kids now come in for a little morning snuggle, and it's probably the highlight of my day. It's the best. It's the best. But it has to be. If it starts with a 4, they're back in their room. 5:30, I can just about cope with. And we're going to squeeze in one last question. This is from Lindsay, saying,
sure.
any advice for traveling with a very little one? First time flying with our daughter, 7 weeks old, combination fed. We're going back to the UK for 10 days, and her sleep is all over the place. Congratulations, Lindsay, new mum. I have to say, 7 weeks old, I found that quite a good time to fly. Maybe we were lucky as well. What would you say?
No, that's what I was going to say. With the 7 weeks old, it's actually very, very, very easy. They're going to be stressed because, yes, it is the first time, and I'm sure it's the first baby as well. So you're stressed about the possibility of your baby starting to cry in the middle of the plane. But look, it's so very easy with a little one because they just, at 7 weeks, they just sleep anywhere, anytime. So just, I would say, get your baby carrier with you to hold the baby for as long as you need to hold the baby. I think to the UK is about 8 hours flight, and there's not much time difference, so it shouldn't be a problem at all. Just don't stress.
Takes me back.
Maybe
Lindsay,
some white noise if you want.
Yes, I was going to say, if I was packing a bag for that plane, Lindsay, here's what I'd have in it. Exactly as I was saying, that baby carrier, because they can't be in the bassinet the whole time for takeoff and landing. So strap it to you. Pack extra clothes for you and her in case of some spit up situation. And if she is combination fed, Ida might not want to be, you know, might be easier to take some formula in bottles in case you're feeling a bit self-conscious on the plane. Breastfeeding. So to cover all eventualities, definitely pack some spare clothes. Isabel, for anyone that is needing your advice one-on-one, maybe we couldn't get to their question today, or it's a bit more complicated and requires some assistance, what's the best way of getting in touch with you guys at Savvy Sleep?
Well, social media for sure. We're on Instagram at Savvy Sleep, at savvy.sleep. You can find us there.
Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Have a lovely Eid break if you're going away yourself. And if anyone wants the details, send me the word sleep and I will send you that link. Be very happy to connect you. Exam season is underway. Stressful for everyone, to be honest, students and parents alike. But like many parents, we have high expectations of our kids. But how can we make sure that we keep a healthy amount of pressure on, but also make time for resting and playing efficiently? And then joining us from the Family Hub, who's got first-hand experience of this as a mum and both an education consultant, to offer some insights and advice. If this is something you're struggling with, do feel free to reach out in the usual channel of your preference. Hanan, how are you?
I'm good, Helen. How are you?
I'm well, thank you for asking. Although I have to say, exam season gives me a bit of mild PTSD. I wasn't a particularly good student, especially when I think about my A-levels. I studied what I felt I was good at and then neglected what I didn't enjoy because I wasn't good at it. And it drove my mum to absolute distraction. I would hear her car in the driveway and run from the TV to the desk where I would be pretending to do some work. And yeah, I was a deceptive little nightmare, to be honest, when it came to studying, and got the results that I deserved because of that. What about you? Taking you back to your exams, what were your behaviours like?
Well, I'm still doing exams because I'm doing my second master's degree right now. But what I'm like is like I'm extremely stressed out. You know, I'm on the other side of the spectrum, Helen. I like to get the straight A's and everything. So I study and then I study and then I revise and everything. And I've actually realized that the less I do, the better I perform.
Ooh.
And this was, I know, and this was one of the papers that I actually wrote in my first master's degree about how when we, you know, batch whatever it is that we need to do and put in breaks, we actually perform better because our brain needs to relax. And when we don't give the brain enough time to sleep and rest and exercise and eat and everything, then it doesn't process all the information that you're trying to give it in. So it doesn't perform, it doesn't remember.
Maybe that's why I did all right. I got two A's and a D. And I think it was because I did have the balance, not intentionally. Can we talk about the two extremes that we're hearing on the text line, that I'm hearing from parents around Dubai? The overworking and then the not doing a thing. And let's start with, you know, it is extreme academic pressure, whether it comes from parents, from the school, from their peers, from, you know, their own expectations. Extremely stressed out kids, where this is the biggest thing in their lives right now. You know, this is what has all been working towards, those exams, those results, and they feel like they need to do everything in their power. How can we introduce the concept of a bit of balance while respecting that they really do want to do their best?
Well, first off, I mean, we need to actually accept that they're going to be doing other things other than studying, because that's very difficult for us as parents. We know the pressure, university, GPA, like everything's on our backs, right? And it's extremely competitive. So as parents, we have to start by letting ourselves go a little bit and then really supporting them with, you know, what kind of schedule do you need? What kind of routine do you need? If there's a baby in the house, you know, maybe not have the baby cry all night and just remove the baby away from the situation so that the kids can actually sleep at night. You know, simple things. But honestly speaking, like I'm joking, but honestly speaking, we need to get our kids into a happy routine, which means that every maybe hour and a half, if they're actually going to sit for an hour and a half, we help them to get up, you know, do some exercise, walk the dog, watch some TV, play with their friends online, like do something that is away from studying, but then actually have a deal with them that when they have that break, that they actually get back. And it's not easy, but these are the conversations that parents need to keep having all the time, and making sure that the kids are actually sleeping and not resorting to anything else to keep them just, you know, wide open and awake when they should be getting their 8 to 10 hours at night.
What about revision timetables and techniques? Because, you know, back in our day, I had post-its everywhere. I had highlighters. I had a calendar that I tried to keep to. In fact, I think I counted creating the calendar as basically part of the revision. I mean, times have changed an awful lot, and technology has as well. Are there any, you know, actionable, you know, data, techniques, apps that you found to be particularly helpful for you? And of course, you know, the kids and families that you're working with.
Well, honestly speaking, Helen, I think that the kids need to put their own schedules. We need to help them out. But again, the more realistic it is, the better off it is. So if I know that my child has an attention span of like, you know, half an hour, and then putting in a schedule that's there for like 3 continuous hours, we know that this is doomed for failure. So we can't really have any of that going on. There are tons of apps out there that help kids do that. But here's the thing. When you have your schedule on an app, then you're going to be checking your phone and then you're getting distracted.
So oh my goodness, 100%. Okay, let's talk about that other extreme, which is not doing a thing. And I know actually a few parents that are really worried about this, and the pain point seems to be from their kind of diagnosis is that the kids are almost paralyzed by how much they've got to do. So it feels easier to not do anything at all. And this was me with my French. You know, I knew I wasn't going to do very well. So it was like, it's like this elephant that you just can't even nibble at. So what about even just starting to get some revision in place, even at this late stage? Any insights there?
Yeah, I mean, when it gets too overwhelming, we just say, okay, you know what? I'm just not going to do this. That's it. It's out of the window. And what really helps with us, you know, we've spoken about this before because I have ADHD and I diagnosed as an adult. So one of the things that actually helps is to batch in very small quantities. Let's say we have 10 chapters. I'm not going to get 10 chapters done. That's fine. But I can get 3 done. And I'm just going to start with the first 3 pages. once I'm done with that, there's a big check mark that's done. I take a break and then we start again. The thing is that we need to help them get the ball rolling. It's not easy to get the ball rolling at the beginning. So here's when parents need to, you know, put on the parent cap and say, all right, I'm going to help you. I might get you a tutor. I might get somebody to help you out, an older kid who has done this before that you trust and that can help us out, things like this. Online support, there are tons of places that you can get support, because sometimes it's just that first initial start that's very difficult to get through. And maybe we just need to hold their hand a little bit, even if they don't want their hands to be held. If they're teenagers, they don't want their hands to be held at that point in time. It's okay. I mean, we always say, hate me for the right reasons. So you can hate me for that reason, and then we can get it moving.
Hanan, I wanted to ask you about on the day, those nerves, those panics, perhaps, and anything that you found to be particularly helpful for, you know, really making your teen know that you are on the same team as them. What do you think are some useful or indeed not at all useful phrases for making sure that they know that you will love them no matter what comes back from those results?
Yeah, again, it's the constant conversation. Like, you've done your best. Have you done your best? Whatever it is that you've done, we're going to learn from it, and so on and so forth. Please do not revise on the day or like 2 minutes before the exam. None of this. It just needs to be a complete distraction, because this is exactly what the brain needs to remember and get the memory rolling so that they can do well and perform well on the exam. Do something fun when they're done. So if they want to go out with their friends, that's amazing. If we can take them out for ice cream and or just for a talk and a conversation and, you know, some junk food, that's perfectly okay for the occasion. And, you know, just stop talking about it all the time. Stop looking at universities 24/7. Like, stop hogging the conversation around what the exam result is going to be. Just let it go. And then when it comes, then we have these conversations.
Well, thank you. And all the very best with your revision. It sounds like you're doing an amazing job. Keep us posted. And again, to all of the students listening today, to all the parents, massive virtual hugs. You're going to be great. So Hanan, for anyone that wants to seek your advice as an education consultant with your parenting courses, you are, of course, there at the Family Hub on Instagram. And is that the best way of getting in touch with you?
Yes, that's the best way to get in touch.
Okay, brilliant.
Thank you, Helen, for having me as always. Have a great
it's
day.
It's a pleasure. Take care of yourself. With news of a 92-kilometre cycle track, an indoor tunnel, and the sport of cycling exploding in popularity, it's never been cooler to be on two wheels. But how safe is it, especially for children? Charlie Senior joining us now, a young man on a mission to make Dubai's streets safer with his campaign, Be Cool, Wear a Helmet to School. Welcome, Charlie. How are you?
Hi, Helen. Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm really happy to be here. I'm really keen to hear about what you've been working on. Before we get to the campaign, though, how old are you and what school do you go to?
I'm 10 and I go to Jumeirah Primary School, or JPS.
So tell us a little bit about, it's a great name, by the way. I love a rhyme. Be cool, wear a helmet to school. Where did the idea for this campaign come from?
The idea for this campaign started when I started to notice how many kids, parents and even teachers were riding to school without wearing helmets. So I decided to do some research, and I encountered them riding to and from JPS. And I found that only a third of the people which were wearing helmets, and it was all students who were wearing them. Mm-hmm. Not one adult on the days as I did my research was wearing a helmet. And the same with scooters.
I think something, you know, we love cycling as a family, and it's something my husband's really strict about setting a good example to our kids. And I'm not going to lie, sometimes I worry about a helmet messing up my hair, Charlie, but I do wear one, because it's not just about us being safe as cyclists and scooters. It's about, you know, maybe not being sure about how safe people in cars are around us as well. Are you able to speak about some of the dangers then? What does the science or the research say about what happens if you don't wear a helmet?
Well, this is a great question, Helen. Statistics from Cleveland Clinic state that wearing a helmet reduces serious injury by 60% into on your head and reduces the number of cyclists killed or seriously injured by 34%. Wearing a helmet won't stop you getting into an accident, but it will greatly aid your survival. Funny story is that my dad was in a bike accident a very long time ago. His helmet was smashed, and the police told him if he hadn't been wearing one, then that would have been his brain.
Oh, gosh. So this is personal to you as well, thinking about your dad in that situation. Now, you're saying just about a third of people wearing helmets when they should be. What are some of the reasons or excuses, and maybe it's them messing up their hair, that you've heard from people about why they're not wearing one, Charlie?
Well, here are some of them. I've never gone to an accident when not wearing a helmet, so why should I wear one? This is the worst excuse by far. Followed by, it's too hot, too big, too uncomfortable, I forgot it, I don't have one, I don't like the colour, it'll mess up my hair.
Guilty of the last one, but I promise I overcome it.
Too uncomfortable, too uncomfortable, and there is no good excuse to not wear a helmet, and it's also the law here in Dubai.
That is such a good point, actually. It is a legal thing, and I've seen people have their bikes even being confiscated for not wearing the proper safety equipment, and you know, you don't want to lose your wheels. So what, I mean, you mentioned a couple of things there about it's not comfortable, or you know, I don't like the colour. What should we look for when we're choosing one? Are there any styles or information on fit that, you know, if we're going into a bike shop, that you know we should be keeping in mind?
Well, the first and most important thing is the fit, like you said. If the helmet doesn't fit you, don't buy it. The difference between wearing one that puts too much pressure on your head and one that doesn't put enough. Mm-hmm. And to check if this is, so once you put on the helmet, wiggle your head. If it moves too much, it's too big. If it doesn't move, it's too small. And you can also tell by feeling, by if there's any pressure on it, the sides, front, or back of your head. The next step is to measure two fingers from your eyebrows to make sure it sits on your head properly. And then tighten the safety clip, I guess, at the back of your head, at the back of the helmet to make it fit well. And then shake your head and see if it doesn't fall off. Then you can put the chin strap up, which you can tell if it's big enough by putting three fingers under your chin. If there's too much playfulness, it's too loose. And if there's not enough, then it's too tight.
This is all great information.
I actually made a video. Yeah, on this exact topic. You can watch it on my Instagram. Stay cool, wear a helmet to school.
I love this. Stay cool, wear a helmet to school. So it's been a great response. I've seen you all over social media. You're on national radio now, Charlie. What are your hopes for the campaign? Where would you like this to go?
Well, my hope is that the campaign spreads through all the schools in the UAE. And from now on, everyone is wearing a helmet while riding a bike or scooter. In September, I also hope to raise money and awareness through charity bike rides in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, so I can buy helmets for those people in the community who can't afford them.
I love this, Charlie. I think you need to get some stickers made and you can stop putting them on people's bikes and scooters and have exactly that.
Yeah.
Stay cool, wear a helmet to school. You're there on Instagram, some brilliant resources and talking about exactly what we've been addressing today, how to fit a helmet, how to choose one and why it is so important. Charlie Senior, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate your time. You're an absolute superstar, a total inspiration. And hopefully you're changing some minds of people listening today. And a great message from Julie here saying nothing more effective than a child calling out, and adults, we need to model this behaviour that we want to see. Charlie, have a great afternoon. All the very best to you and the gang at school. And I live near you and live near that school, so I'll be keeping an eye out to see if we've got an increase in helmets around JPS. Charlie Senior, if you want to find out more, you can check out his campaign, Stay Cool, Wear a Helmet to School. First, though, we are turning our attentions to the workplace. Joining us from Bain & Company is Anne-Laure Morozak. She is the Regional Chief of Diversity, Equity and Inclusion. They recently reported a survey on exactly this, that I have to say, when I saw the numbers, I was quite taken aback. So we've brought you on, Anne-Laure. Tell us a little bit about what your mission was with this survey in the first place. What were you examining?
Me, Helen, very honored to be here. Look, our mission was to establish a reliable database for women in the workplace because the data is so sparse and it's not always consistent. So we were trying to really understand, where are we today? How are we doing? Are women truly integrated? Especially because we've been seeing these very exciting numbers across the region of increasing workforce participation at crazy growth rates in the kingdom, in Qatar, in the UAE. So we were very excited to see how that integration was going and how organizations were building on the top-down national efforts to push gender equity at an organizational level.
Now, the results were quite sobering, to be honest. Can you tell us about some of the big takeaways? Tell us what maybe surprised you with those findings.
Absolutely. I mean, we originally wanted to title the report Breaking the Bias. And it was all about saying, you know, we're tired of hearing all these stereotypes about the region and that, you know, that the region is behind. We believe that the region actually is pioneering on a lot of different topics. And that has been confirmed. So that was the good news of the report, that we found that practices that are happening in the region, that homegrown organizations are leading in the private sector and in public sector organizations, are actually pioneering at a global level. The bad news, however, and that's, I think, the sobering part you're referring to, was that, you know, the biases were still very much there. When we interviewed female leaders, 70% of them, even at deputy CEO, CEO, managing director level, said that they face, you know, biases on a daily basis. 70% of women really at the top. So you can imagine the rest of the organization when you have that at the top leadership level. What was also sobering is we interviewed male professionals and we found that a significant share of the comments were still, you know, very much rooted in bias and misconceptions, saying things, for example, like, you know, men are more logical than women. So these comments were still coming up and confirmed these biases which exist. And we heard that, you know, again and again in different countries in the region, saying things like, you know, I'm a leader, but a lot of the times the men go for a smoke break and the decision is made when they're downstairs and then they come back and the decision is done. So there's different ways where bias exists, which is really influencing and shaping the experience of women in the workplace today. It's not always intentional bias. Sometimes it can even be, you know, bias that has a good intention. For example, someone just came back from maternity leave and we don't want to, you know, put too much work on her, or give her too much work, removing the agency really from that person to make that decision for herself. It's well-intentioned, but it's still biased and it exists and it really permeates the workplace. And until we solve that, you're still going to have all the other challenges that come up around challenges in mentorship, challenges in hiring, challenges in promotion. So that was really, I think, the two main highlights is we're doing great. We're breaking records when it comes to integration of the labor force. I mean, the participation rates of the workforce we've seen in Saudi, for example, where we've broken the record that we had set for 2030, 7 years in advance, to have 30% female participation in the workforce. The Ministry of Economy and Planning just announced 37%. So we're doing, you know, really well there, and very strong numbers in the UAE and Qatar above global average. But the bias issue is still one that remains and needs to be addressed.
And I think it is through surveys like this that, you know, really make us think, really hopefully make us examine our behaviours and our attitudes as men and as women.
Yes.
I know it sounds like a bit of a, and you are absolutely the right person to ask, are you able to explain a little bit a difference between equality and equity when we're talking about gender in particular?
Yes, absolutely. That's very often a question that that comes up. I think the way we think about it, and that's the definition we use at Bain and is often used in many global organizations, is the idea that, you know, the original system of the workplace was really designed with one population in mind, very historically, traditionally, with men in mind. And so the purpose of equity is not saying we all have to be the same everywhere and have exactly the same, you know, let's say outcomes, but we all need to be given the same opportunities. And that is really what equity is about. It's saying, you know, maybe if you're a woman, there's certain challenges or hindrances you face to your entry and participation in the workplace. So you need an extra help in order to be able to access the same opportunity that one of your male colleagues might be accessing as well. So it's not necessarily, you know, pushing quotas to have exactly the same results. it's saying let's give people the same opportunity access. And sometimes that means giving extra help to segments like women that may have additional challenges to face in getting access to those opportunities.
Anna, can I ask you a little bit about the five pillars to your mind of yes. gender equity? Are you able to kind of really lay them out for us, for anyone listening today who might be in leadership, who might be in HR, who might want to start, you know, really putting their company to task about some actionable things that can be put in place? Those five pillars, if you wouldn't mind.
No, absolutely. I think that the first one is, you know, do you have a clear plan, vision, and leadership commitment? Are there targets and goals that your organization has committed to and communicated visibly? That's really critical. The second one is in how you recruit, hire, and grow people, right? Because we often see we hire amazing women and then we lose them as they grow in seniority. So the career journey from hiring all the way to promotions and growth and professional development is really key. The third one is salary parity. There have been an amazing number of organizations. Shenhu Group is a good example of one, for example, where they've made a lot of efforts to make sure that there is pay equity analysis. And when it doesn't happen in the way that we want, we fix it. So that's the third pillar. The fourth one is maybe the hardest, but it's around culture and building a culture of inclusion and support. So do you have, for example, groups in the workplace that support women? Do you have yearly surveys where you hear and listen from your employees, both male and female, to hear about inclusion, equity, how they feel? We found that a lot of times bias manifests in people not feeling included. And by the way, men also sometimes don't feel included. It's not just a female issue, it's just that we see it being more accentuated there. So the fourth one is around building this culture of inclusion and support. It's really important. And the last one is then how you engage with the external stakeholder, whether it's your customers, like retail companies do, or the community around topics of gender equity. But if I may, I think one of our, you know, famous female leaders in the region said it really comes down to four things. Are you hiring women and hiring in them in a way that is unbiased? Are you promoting them? Are you investing in them? And are you giving them supportive policies when it comes to maternity leave, especially? Because those are really structural things that make a difference in the day-to-day lives of women.
Anne-Law, can I ask you lastly, you are Regional Chief of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion there at Bain & Company, but if I was to give you a different job title and make you, and let's say, Minister of Labour for the world, what would be the biggest change that you would like to see companies put in place to achieve real gender equity?
I think make a concerted effort to hire women, of course, you know, with the qualifications and talent. We have a lot of very talented women. Encourage organizations to do that, because what we've seen is once you reach 30% women in organization, the culture changes and the bias is really tackled that way, just by having more women, more qualified women in the workplace. So I would try and focus on helping organizations to better their hiring processes so we can get more successful women in the workplace. And thankfully, a lot of GCC organizations are doing that and are doing that really well. So we're really starting to see a shift in the region through organizations as well.
And, you know, let's not shy away from the fact that, yes, it's great to have that representation, but it's great for the bottom line. We've heard time and time again, whether it's gender, nationality, religion, age,
100%.
You know, that diversity comes back up in absolute
and
spades.
We have regional data, Helen, to prove that for the first time. We have data from organizations we interviewed and diagnosed that show that, you know, teams with women on the team have higher productivity, etc. So that's been a very also enlightening part of this research.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this survey to light that you're there with Bain & Company. If anyone wants to find out more about it, dig deeper into the results, is there a way of accessing that information?
Yes, absolutely. It's available online. It's been published. So please do check our website, bain.com, and the Middle East. You'll find it in the publications. And don't hesitate to reach out to us, the authors.
Thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It is heating up out there. We've got Eid around the corner, and then before you know it, it's going to be the summer holidays. So panic no more. We are sorting out not only your social life, we're sorting out the kids' schedule and saving you some money as well. Michelle joining us from Kids Mobile App. That's Kids with a Q, with some great deals, some great ideas as well. Michelle, how are you?
Hi, Helen. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
I'm good. Thank you for asking. We're having a great time here at SeaWorld. I have to say, it's been brilliant to get through the doors and see what all it's all been. It's been happening for years now.
It sounds amazing.
It is. The scale of it is absolutely mind-blowing. I've spent the whole time just walking around going, oh my goodness, this place. So I have to say, come 5 o'clock, I think Poonam and I are going to have a little explore and maybe have a go on a roller coaster. Why not? So thank you for your time. And again, thank you for all the hard work that goes on with you guys, making our lives a little bit easier. I've already started panicking a little bit about the summer because it's Eid. And then I think we've got about 2 days of school and then it's the summer holidays and I am not prepared at all. So can we talk summer camps? Because I think hopefully there's something for everybody, whether it's, you know, sporty, creative, active. What's got you excited, Michelle?
Of course. And you're right. You know, already the parents are starting to scramble a little bit because you're right. You know, time is running out really, really super fast. You know, you've got Eid around the corner, then the kids, you know, are going to finish up, you know, and so, but we're very lucky that, you know, we've put together and curated a list of summer camps that not only run for a week here, a week there, but, you know, from pretty much beginning of July right through to the end of August. So this really, really helps our busy parents who, you know, have office life themselves and they're working themselves for those not traveling, etc. So these are super, super cool. I have some here in mind, if you'd like me to share them with you.
Yeah, let's go.
Amazing. So the first one that actually I always find is really, really helpful for parents is AIS Athletics. Now they're running some camps in Dubai American Academy in Barsha. You can have anything from a 1 day camp, 2 day camp, right up to 30 days. But they're also having a thing called mini Olympics. So while the children are in the camp, they can, you know, run, hop, skip, jump, do all the fun things, but they get points, they can get medals at the end. So it makes them a little bit more competitive, but at the same time, they're burning energy, they're having fun, and it helps mom and dad out who, you know, may not have the time and really need to be helped out with these camps.
So this is a sporty one as well. And I think for me, our kids do a huge amount of sport during the week. You know, they've got swimming at school, they've got after-school activities, they've got PE at school, and then that summer comes and it's difficult to be outside and be active there. So sports camps can, you know, really keep them moving and get them nicely tired out. So that's a DAA in Barsha, AIS Athletics. We had a message earlier asking about football camps, and I think a lot of kids who are in after-school activities will continue with, you know, with those companies. Are there any that are offering, you know, football camps to just anyone that wants to come along?
Yes, and I think a lot of the PE teachers and the football coaches would be very happy to hear that they're continuing their training throughout the summer, which is amazing. One on our mind is Elite Sports. They're hosting an intensive football camp. So that can be, again, 1 day, 5 day camp. It's in Raffles International School in Umm Sakin. Your prices start, you know, from a 1 day, but also actually there's an early bird offer on kids right now for a 5 day camp. So you can save, I think it's almost 100 dirhams if you book that on a kids mobile app as well.
Also on your, I'm just aware we've got so much to talk about. Also on your recommendations, there's Treehouse, which is there at Blue Waters, Funky Monkeys. Yes. And I've had a number of messages on my Instagram saying, you know, my kid's only three. Are there any camps? So Funky Monkeys, which is Wassel, has, you know, ages from three upwards. And robotics as well. Tell us about Fun Robotics, because this isn't a sporty one, but definitely a creative one. What's it all about, Michelle?
Yeah, so Fun Robotics has a number of different courses that you can choose yourself. So everything, and you're right, it's very, very creative. You know, anyone with a coding mind or anyone that just wants to get their hands dirty and put stuff together, you know, with some mechanics and all that stuff. So again, they have 1 week summer camps that you can do. You can choose the course that you want. All the details are there. But yeah, again, it's really nice to see something so creative that's there for the kids.
Now we are here indoors at SeaWorld today, and as I said, the scale of it's just enormous. You could be in here all day without needing to leave. Can we talk about some of your other favourite indoor attractions? Where else comes to mind? And I wanted to ask you about one in particular because it caught my eye on Instagram. It's Aya, A-Y-A.
Yeah.
Have you been? Yeah. And do you know what it's all about?
I have. It is absolutely, it was actually on my list that this is one of the things that I was super excited about. It's down in Waffle City. It's an immersive experience. So there's 12 zones that you can go. So I don't have kids. So when my niece Electra was in town last week, I took her down and my God, she loved it. She's 10. So she was like super excited to see all of these immersive experiences. And that is super, super cool and a really fun way to spend an afternoon. And, you know, it's a really, you know, reasonable on the pricing as well. The prices start from 84 dirhams, which is really good to spend a couple of hours in the afternoon.
I'm actually being super organized this weekend. My husband flies away tonight for a wedding to France. So it's just me and the girls this weekend. And I am treating them to camping in Green Planet. Tomorrow night, we are going to be sleeping inside the biodome. I'm going to be getting some ear-canceling headphones. And I cannot wait to meet the sloths again. And they're doing all sorts of like movies and animal encounters. And it's going to be fantastic. But I have to say, Green Planet is one of my favorite spots in the UAE. And I know it's on your list as well. It's just a fantastic one. But you've also got Ski Dubai on there, Trampo Extreme, the Legoland Water Park, IMG. There's so much happening. Also, Dubai Sports World is opening this weekend as well. So
it is.
In terms of good value, my goodness, it's so reasonable for, you know, booking paddle courts, table tennis. Do you know what other sports they've got under that giant roof?
They have got everything you can think of, Helen. Honestly, there's your paddle, there's your table tennis, there's your football, your basketball, everything is there. So, I mean, if you can think of it, it's there pretty much. So, but it's so exciting that it's open this week. And I know it's a super good time as well to be back indoors. Like you said, it's getting super, super hot in Dubai these days. So it'll be nice to be indoors and getting your sweat on, but not so much so when you're outside.
Now, you just mentioned you've got a deal for the Aya immersive experience. In terms of what else is on Kids Mobile app right now, for saving us a few dirhams, what are some of your favourites?
And the Storm Culture in Dubai Hills Mall is always a good one. So that's from 65 dirhams. But again, you're in the mall, you can do some shopping, you can maybe see a movie, you can eat something. And also, you know, you have this fun thing as well that the kids can do. Well, adults can do it too, so which is always a fun thing too.
I was just about to say, it's my daughter's favourite. She realised she was tall enough to do it a few months ago. And she actually wrote on our family calendar, roller coaster, roller coaster, roller coaster, every week until the end of the year, because she just desperately wants to go back on the storm coaster. And she even, this is my daughter who saves money like crazy, even spent her own money so she could go up the front. You wouldn't think, given that it's in a mall, that it would be a particularly scary roller coaster. Oh my goodness, let's just say the photos were absolutely hilarious. I hadn't realized it was on your app. So you say 65 dirhams, 65. That's a storm coaster brilliant.
Dubai Hills Mall.
And I mentioned Green Planet there. Is there a deal to be had?
There is. You can get your tickets for 49 dirhams.
Wow, that's much more reasonable than I was thinking. And lastly, we've got time for one
more,
Michelle.
It's probably a bit more expensive for your
camping, but... I think it will be, but probably, hopefully worth it. If we've got time for one last recommendation, saving some dirhams for the family, what's some of your top pick there?
Ollie is always a firm favourite with the younger kids. And, you know, when you can get tickets from 45 dirhams, I think that's just a real good bargain, you know?
Ollie is somewhere that we've been going to since it opened about 6 years ago now. And it's somewhere that the kids get something different out of every single time, you know, because they're different ages. They might be in the mood to, you know, to climb or to get messy and also they do an amazing job of having new exhibitions and new exhibits and new interactive experiences. So it's a firm favourite, a brilliant one for the summer. I'm going to investigate if they've got a camp because I think my kids would love it. In the meantime, though, Michelle, I knew you'd know. For all of this and more, you need to download Kids Mobile app, Kids with a Q. Thank you so much for your time today. Massively appreciate it.
Thanks.
You've been sorting us out with some brilliant ideas there. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.